You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry on KTAH 101.9 FM, Radio Tacoma. I am your host, David Gilmore. And today we have Khun Woon. We're actually going to be sitting at a table as though we're in a cafe. There won't be a lot of ambient noise, but Khun is going to do his very best to be just about the perfect reader he can be, because his poetry is good and you have to hear it. Khun, welcome to Sound Poetry.
Thank you, David.
So we're going to start with a beat poem, but first let me tell you, Khun has... I have... more than half a dozen, seven or eight books right in front of me that he has published. You look his name up, he's got a website. And Khun is very well worth finding out if your library has it, if you can't afford the books. But I can assure you the books will not disappoint. But we're hearing some poems that probably aren't in collections, so we're kind of lucky today.
The first poem I'd like to read today has a title that's quite long. It's called Number 1105-KW-First Series, Number 1. The reason it's titled this way is 1105 refers to the room I lived in, a high-rise building, at one time, Seattle Housing. Did you know you can write a poem such as this one? And you can go up to the mic and read this poem, saying, "This is my poem." And you will hear a poem such as this one in cafes like this one. I approve of realities like this one, inconceivable universes like this one. But I could not tender my principles for your mistress, nor my horse for your house. And did you know that the sunlight is benign through my window, as this heats my room with help of Susie, the goddess of electricity? I do not have my eyeglasses on. What you feel, I feel, because it's with naked skin I touch you, and you in turn touch my most vulnerable spot. Oh, let me be sentimental. It's my heart. My heart throbs to sparrow beats. It throbs to desert weeds. It throbs even to a cactus plant that my grandmother had in my childhood that protected her garden. So, to you who approve of me, though in truth I don't know who I am, but look with me up and down this industrial row, illumined by the sun out of my window. Let's embrace it all. Don't hedge your bet, but come all the way for which is life redeeming. See? It's your life. It's so gloriously projected on the wall.
A beat poet in the name of Khun Woon with one that hits the heart. I'm sure that you feel the real jerk of the sentimentality when it is the heart. And the throbbing to the beat of sparrows or sparrows' beats and hedging your bet. All of it goes together in a way that just seems quite right. I think you beat some of the beats on this one. It is beyond beat.
This is the terrain of a foreign country. Feeling the most not at home, I spy the dying maples, departing trains, emptying diners, frozen lakes, hearing English spoken, American English, this is the strangest of all. Run by algorithms alongside a college campus, the bus chugs on this late October day with a dying sun, penetrating wind blowing from the Puget Sound as ferry boats bump on the choppy water. These streets have dealt me defeat, three times homeless. Seattle, O chief self, I'm your ghost warrior, descending your hellish streets from Mount Pleasant Cemetery on Queen Anne Hill, on the drug craze Capitol Hill, skidding down Pioneer Square, on these roads toward the water. I cannot deny I'm here, almost a native son in space-time continuum with the claim of citizenship. But the city prohibits camping, partition, park benches, the sparse bar and nightclubs in the King County Jail conspire to remove me because my pockets are empty. Unmoved by your loss of real estate as the taxis go on rampages, the bottom line, I'm simply here. Once there was Andy's Cafe on Broadway that for $1.50 serves you half a baked chicken onto your plate, and the Hasty Tasty on the Ave will sell you a midnight bowl of chili. For all I have filled my belly and scribbled these verses, neither in the Helix nor in the Stranger, but they have mentioned me in the LA Bay Book and Company as someone who inhabited the truth of rented rooms. However, it's to no avail, even as the waterfront rails hum, as I go limping insanely to accelerate my life. This is not a city of managed growth, but of unnatural wares. As AI searches for better brains to make its batteries and to feed its nasty machines, or the Amazon wildly flows down to South Lake Union, and people die a slow death, but they prefer to die among those castles in the air, where the rich and poor live side by side, or stacked together, while the Fry Art Museum swallows its own parking lot, in a manner the city center fountain loses its coins. The girl I quoted Hegel and Marx to was named Elise, and I never loved her except in my mind, but my heart lost its thumping to a different rhythm. It took too long to find a sustainable beat. I have lived in an SRO in a grandfathered hotel. I live among the roaches. They can dance my name on the dresser, but I live there and I still do. Even have I straddled the cracks of an earthquake, where the earth breathes out in China and the COVID ends up here. Damn you politicians, damn you all. Let us die quietly. You need us, but do we need you? This is a very foreign country indeed, a country that could have been mine. I could have proudly called it my own.
The word beat appears in this one and does have some, I think, of the protesting declaration and the denunciation of country for what values it has been stuck with and that don't serve all the people and make life easy for people. This is a protest poem, especially as you conclude. How did it come about? Is it brand new, or is it one that goes back in? Is it a memoir, for example? Is it memory?
Well, I think this poem in its original state was written a couple of lines years ago, and it just came to me about 2-3 weeks ago, just its final form. A lot of my poems come to me that way. I reworked them in my mind over time, and then when the what I call poetic feeling hits me, I sit down and just flows out on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. It speaks of a loneliness and some dire situation may be at hand in it. I mean, it gives you an edgy feeling that something is really going haywire in the city. Did you, you intended that to be quite pointed about the contemporary situation, right?
Well, I don't see much improvement in the last 3 years since I've been homeless.
Mm-hmm.
I've been homeless twice in Seattle, once San Francisco. That was a long time ago, but I still see many, many people in tents, many, many people just literally dying on the street. It has not improved too much. In fact, if you take statistically, there are more people homeless than there were 30, 40 years ago. So, But let's move on.
Move on.
Something silly.
I think that you were trying to do something silly with Elise, talking about Hegel and Marx in that one, yeah, too, weren't you?
Yeah. Elise is the song Beethoven dedicated to,
okay,
for Elise.
Oh. So it's not the name of a responding machine.
Okay. This is a maybe a lighter mood.
Okay.
This is a nonsense poem.
All right.
A lot of people have cats, so this is a cat poem. Cheshire, none the worser. There was a cat from Cheshire who loved salmon with Worcestershire sauce and fought with his arbitrary owner, who claimed to be the boss. The cat was named Fat, and the human fellow was named Splats, who lost all his money at the stocks when it fell to nil. And so the fellow's wife, known as Lil, divorced the potbelly SOB and left the scene with all the fleas. And so Splats climbed onto the building ledge and fought the battle full-fledged, finished the whole bottle of gin. Then he fought the wind, took the dare and jumped down the air. Meanwhile, Fat finished the salmon and rolled contentedly on the ground. When Splats exhausted the altitude and hit the sidewalk head first, people stood and gawked and all agreed he was indeed the fellow named Splats.
Roadrunner and what is the other one? Is it Coyote and Roadrunner?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, you've got definitely an Aesop's fable at work in that. But you called it a silly poem. Is it because it's for children or for everybody who might like a silly poem?
Well, I think it wasn't a T.S. Eliot wrote a cat poem.
Yeah, he was very fond of cats. That was the way he sort of stabilized himself. He says, after fooling around with all this philosophical, metaphysical stuff, I got to write another cat poem.
Yeah. Well, my ex and I had a cat, a tuxedo cat named Tuxie. And it was a very smart cat and very friendly. It was a therapeutic cat, because once I passed out, and he stayed with me the whole time until he came to. So anyway, he was worrying.
Yeah. What are we going to venture from after the silliness of cats going splat?
Here's a poem about everyday people, everyday machinery. Okay. The inadvertent sounds of everyday machinery. In this town, dogs make dog sounds in the dogged afternoons as they climb over each other, while in fall winds, three-leaf clovers tremble, camouflaged by weeds. Within inverted sounds, the compost dampen, a mix of concrete, hybrid machinery, and sawdust circumscribe the daily acts of this small town as I sort three boxes of notes that the son of the minister wants to read. While revising them, I add a pinch of salt to food bank food in a skillet, stewing slowly the tomatoes. As I slowly turn my love for you over and over, as my art begins. In tough time, I'm tough, but in lonely hours, I realize how much time I have lost, as I am jet-lagged, still chasing my pain, the pain having lost you, but I still craft for you, and the radio agrees, but the pigeons will not arrive yet under the eaves, but I hear your voice still, in the stillness of my heart.
All right. So, very lyrical and almost a love poem in its conclusion. But you do speak about quite a lot of experience in those earlier verses. I mean, those are sensations and things that are happening that are quite delightful. It's not anything to make you feel sad for you if you have those experiences. What do you think?
I think somebody posted the other day on Facebook, some love is the best thing to have, but if you don't have love, maybe need is the next best thing.
Need.
So if you maybe not love, but if your needs are satisfied.
Satisfying your needs. Is that satisfying then through those mundane experiences that seem quite like life? Right?
Yeah, I mean, life for most people is the satisfaction and needs.
But you really pick it up with the emotion, with the love lyric at the end.
Yeah.
That is very bright and, you know, leaves a person feeling very, well, good in sentiments.
Yeah. Well, I think the last two poems I read will show that side of me. But we'll get to that in the end.
Okay.
This one is called Night Recedes. When blood surges throughout the city, when ruined minds rule the night, one can expect what is expected now. As light bends along the curved road to infinity, only to discover signs that again exhort the familiar. I was here the previous night, when the worn grooves of my brain pulverized the twigs of late autumn, fearing the undertow of youthful errors dragged me to dangerous depths as I thrash in humiliation and anger. What's injured should not be injured again. Time will pass in the city, where the slow dives with low blood sugar lights, where the viaducts speed past the docks, where the stevedores spit chew tobacco, where the produce trucks bring farmers dirt, where the night here penetrates another virgin, why I am untouched, unloved, unknown, and uncaring, wishing only that I could boombox the night away. Ghetto youths with gangrene feet, shuffling away from the fight, knowing they face the universe all alone. At this point of the narrative, my psychiatrist tells me to remember humanity when a big rock drops on my foot. I don't know. Three men and ten worship life, three men and ten worship death, and three men and ten merely go from life to death, and I'm the one unaccounted for, even though I'm registered as a credit card holder.
Do you think that one has also a flavor of the beat, because it's about the street life a little bit?
The lower working class, almost the lumpen proletariat, the riffraff class. Mm-hmm. People have to live on the streets. People have to sell drugs. People have to do what they have to do to survive. People step up, like people working baristas in the Starbucks.
Sure.
They're not doing that much better. And then work for Amazon delivering packages to houses. They're not doing that much
not
better.
Not so good, maybe.
We're becoming.
But that person who is the stevedores chewing tobacco, I know that stevedores are actually very well paid in their union. That's one where it's almost seen from afar. From the viaduct, you might see the stevedores at work.
Mm-hmm.
And they are at a distance, I think, in your poem, mm-hmm. rather than our feeling close to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you're right, there's so little compensation for a lot of people that work in the street and maybe can't find homes beyond the street.
Okay. Well, this would be a turning away from beat poetry a little bit here.
Okay.
On a boarded formal verse, should I study poetry, its forms and sounds, as the subject varies beyond all bounds? Or could I write it any way I please, while mindful of a cat's tail full of fleas? And as I scratch out these notes, unlike alligators in the moat, eager to snap at you, which I ain't aiming to do, but to lift you up above the blue, prosody, rhapsody, may they judiciously combine, as the rake I follow the mowing from behind.
Now, did I see an urge in you to stand up and start gesticulating when you... did you imagine yourself at a poetry slam reading that one? What is the title of that one again?
On aborted formal verse.
Okay. So the formality is there, I suppose, mostly in the rhyme.
Yeah.
forget the rest, right? For the most part, it's the rhyme.
Well, it's sometimes. Well, let me tell you
end
this
rhyme.
Joke.
End rhyme at that.
Let me tell you this joke. My professor told me his name was Nelson Bentley. I had a student who was very interested in the poetic forms. Mm-hmm. The more complicated, the better. And so he invented a very, very complicated form. Nelson Bentley asked him, "Well, what do you call it?" He said, "Half Nelson." He was still dissatisfied with it. He wanted to build an even more complex, complicated form.
Yeah.
He tried so hard, he went insane. And was never heard of again. And I said to, quipped to Professor Bentley, "Well, Professor Bentley, maybe they got him in an insane asylum, got him in a judo hole, in a full Nelson."
Okay, that's it.
Of course, the whole thing was a joke.
Yeah, right.
The whole thing was a joke.
Yeah, right. Sure, that's pretty bright. But poor fellow, to go mad. Mad with poetry.
Well, that was a joke that Nelson Bentley told, because he was not strict about forms and formal poetry.
Well, that's right. Formal poetry will drive you mad, right?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Especially if you rhyme too much.
Yeah.
I suppose rhyme, though, was there in the very beginning, but you don't see it too much in the actual languages in Greek and Roman poetry. Much later on, rhymes came to be a formal element, an ending of a line impact.
In that vein, I read another pseudo-formal poem. Okay. Pseudo-formal poem. Midnight. What human business is best done at night when it calls candles to provide light? In what military posture straight in the day is best executed in the simplest way? The heart without convolutions will unthinkingly answer a midnight knock, while a heart coiled in the dark is apprehensive of barking dogs. In the dark time, the eye begins to see all the foul hearts on the ceiling above, blacker than black, espousing brotherly love, like adding white sugar to saccharine tea. But brothers, all I need is a simple love, as delivered by the feather of a single dove. Then I can turn a corner past midnight, winning the war without a fight.
In taking that into formal verses, stanzas of four lines that had rhyme, were you actually modeling, thinking of some older, more formalist poet that did that sort of thing? Or was that an exercise that you chose to give yourself, or what?
I think that was more of an exercise just for myself. That has undergone many revisions over time, maybe over a 20-year period.
It is four stanzas of four lines each, right? With an A-B type of rhyme?
Mm-hmm. Right. A-A-B-B.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that one does sound like it could be something that had a 19th century form with a name to it, too. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that depending on the type of poem, it might have been called lyric.
Mm-hmm.
Or something else. Mm. What was the title again of that?
Midnight.
Midnight. Okay. Is there a prayer quality to that one? That what you're asking for there from your brothers?
From the Book of War, The Art of War by Sun Tzu, the Chinese strategist, he said the best victory is achieved without fighting.
Yeah.
Peace actually is the best victory. The best answer to war. If you can avoid war and win, then that's the best way to fight.
Right. Well, the camaraderie of warfare, too, with others, is often what drives people to stay in the game to the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have a request for a much more peaceful solution, but the fight goes on.
Well, I often ask my friend, the psychiatrist, he's my friend above about being a, he's a psychiatrist, but not my psychiatrist. He's a friend.
A friend.
I asked him, I said, Larry, is there something in us, you know, imperfect animal beings that causes us to fight, to kill, to rob, whatever we do that are so-called bad?
Right.
Or is that the institutions we came up with, capitalism, economic system, militarism, all those things, which cause us to do that? He said, I don't know. So there's a combination of both, I think. Our institutions were invented, like capitalism, which has evolved to the monopoly capitalism and the financial capitalism, which is quite different from the old, you know, the Adam Smith days, where, where you actually have to produce a service or a gadget, you know, for your money.
Right.
A service or product for your money. Right. Now all you have to do is have, lend money out to make money.
Capitalism, though, is sort of fraught with a lot of competition, which is kind of a fighting. It's an antagonism.
Right.
And that also goes for... for other kinds of connections and relationships where you can't avoid some sort of competition. The DNA, for example, it was in soon after Darwin had published his book on that, the idea of survival of the fittest, you know, the one that can fight to be on the top of the heap and all that, that kind of metaphor.
Actually, that's wrong.
It is wrong.
Yeah.
But it caught on as a kind of kitchen sink way of talking about it, which it is a perversion.
Yeah.
Well, but capitalism can be perverted too into warfare.
Well, the thing is, like, the environment decides who survives. The genes produce the potential, produce the variety that one of them will survive. It's the environment which chooses which survives. Because the dinosaurs should have survived, but we got hit by meteorites, so they didn't survive. So,
well, the environment's getting more populated. So there's too many people clustering in, and that making antagonistic.
So the ants and cockroaches will survive.
They will, and slugs.
Yeah, right.
Slugs.
So although we're the brightest and the best, strongest, if we're not, we can build a machine to make us strongest, brightest. So we don't necessarily survive. It's the environment which will decide who's going to survive.
Yeah, right.
And we,
I agree.
If we play God and change our environment, then the robots will kick us out. So.
That's right. That's the myth, according to Kun Woon.
Okay. Here's a poem I wrote to a certain editor who accepted all my poems of glee when I wrote about happy things. Uh-huh. As soon as I wrote about social problems, he wanted to distance himself from me. And he said, if you want to write about vomit in the alley, go ahead, but I will never publish them. So when he was leaving town, I wrote this poem. Here you're leaving. The goals of the in the garbage of a seaport, here you're leaving. Hatless statues in the falling rain, here you're leaving. The city shudders from the enormity of grief. I shiver as a single plow in Mesopotamia. The long winters in which my sweaters are straitjackets. When my friends go into the next room, I am often afraid I shall never see them again. I think of the leaves carried by a stream in autumn, as great ships with broken masts, the captain stark mad, and the sailors never siring children. Cling of chinaware being fitted into a box, the van's tailpipe is spewing impatient exhaust. Write in our daybook, now times will visit, the rain keeps falling, it becomes water, water becomes years, I hear you're leaving. The buses of a growing city will wait for no one. Tunnels will be completed on time. My mathematics texts are impossible to open in this awkward cold and damp. The city, however, will go on living. The garbage is picked up. Newspaper go on to news stories. Church bells ring as ships recede from the harbor.
I think you really tested your teacher there, right? It was teacher?
No, it was my editor.
Your editor. You tested with quite a bit of pollution and things, effluents out of things, not the vomit. But you had a few things that were polluting. That was pretty subtle. So how did the person take it?
When I asked for credits on my poems that he previously published, he was very businesslike, mm-hmm. but he never published another poem of mine.
Never did. Did he say anything about that one, though, that seems to have been written in his honor in some respects?
Well, I sent it to him over and over again. He rejected over and over again.
Son of a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a critic for you, isn't it?
Well, he was a difficult person.
Was he a grump?
He was an alcoholic. His later stages, alcoholism.
Depressed?
Angry.
Schopenhauerian?
Schopenhauer was an optimistic guy, actually. He thought the arts would save
us. Some people who try to be Schopenhauer don't come off as optimistic.
Yeah.
I know that.
Mm-hmm.
So was he, did he go off to another job?
No, he had a job, he retired, I believe.
Okay, so it was in retirement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
His work came, he had trouble with every poet that, mm-hmm. you know, that they all left him.
That's too bad. You've got to be somewhat accepting of the qualities of another person's mind.
Some people they don't want the truth. They don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to know the world's changing.
I imagine there's a long history of famous poets who could tell you how long it took before they had an editor or some publisher say. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is pretty good.
The second greatest poet in China, Du Fu, was not heard of in his lifetime. 30 years after he died, people started publishing
him. Up. This is Sound Poetry. I've been your host, David Gilmore, with Seattle poet Kun Woon.